Welcome to the Leeds Church Institute podcast, Learning for a Faithful City. Leeds Church Institute works through educational events, media, city engagements, and a learning centre. Today's podcast was recorded at our Seeking Refuge event. Our keynote speech was given by Francis Webber, the Vice Chair of the Institute of Race Relations. Francis is a former barrister specialising in immigration, refugee and human rights law, and was speaking on making connections, taking solidarity further.
Thank you very much. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. I love these kinds of events because you look at what is going on in terms of governments and politicians and you're full of despair, and then you come to events like this and you meet everybody who is doing so much in terms of support and solidarity work. And it really heartens you again. So it's brilliant. Thank you so much for inviting me. So you will be involved. You are involved, as I've seen from those of you whose stores I've visited, in material support for asylum seekers and refugees, and emotional support, psychological support, legal support, support for dignity and autonomy. And you're probably involved with various campaigns, campaign against indefinite detention, the campaign to welcome more child refugees under the Dubs Amendment, campaigns to improve the quality of asylum housing, campaigns to allow asylum seekers to work. So I'm going to take you a bit further to other kinds of solidarity, other kinds of support, and making the connections, as I said, making the connections. So looking at connections with campaigns against labour exploitation, campaigns or connecting up with people who are, I would call them reluctant enforcers, people in the NHS, teachers and so on, who are finding themselves forced to enforce. They're conscripted into immigration enforcement in various ways. Campaigns or connecting up with the campaigns against the criminalisation of human rights defenders, anti-globalisation and climate change. So I'm going to explain how all these things are connected, hopefully. How long have I got? Okay, so first of all, workplace exploitation. So all of you know that we have seen in this country, but also everywhere else, actually, everywhere else in the world, massive erosion of workplace rights in the past decade or two. In this country, it tends to be through, you know, the protection, the laws are there, but employers have gone under them using agency workers, zero-hours contracts, fake self-employment, all of that. So actually a large proportion of the people who are affected are in fact asylum seekers, people on no recourse to public funds, refused asylum seekers, other undocumented people. And they, of course, are going to be the most vulnerable to workplace exploitation. So in November last year, the Institute of Race Relations was involved in an event called the Permanent People's Tribunal, which I don't know, some of you may have heard of. Permanent People's Tribunal on the violation of the rights of migrant and refugee peoples, that was the title, of a series of hearings in London, Barcelona, Paris, Palermo. So looking at the whole sort of sweep of violations of migrant and refugee rights, but the one in London focused particularly on the hostile environment and on workplace exploitation. So we had people giving evidence from various sectors, hotels and hospitality, cleaning, construction, warehousing, care, domestic work, agriculture, food processing. So basically all the sectors where labour cannot be outsourced to the global south, you find the greatest exploitation in the global north, i.e. the rich countries, yeah? And a lot of those people, as I say, are migrant workers. So the kinds of abuses, in addition to the ones that I've listed, you get systematic under-recording of hours, you get forced overtime, disregard for health and safety, illegal deductions, withholding wages, withholding passports, intimidation, bullying, etc. Replacement of workforces. So we heard about companies in hotels because the housekeeping is all outsourced. The subcontractors bid by the room. They have to bid by the room, not by the number of hours, which then means that the workforce are having to do clean more and more and more rooms. And so a shift which is supposed to take maybe 5 hours takes nine. So the person testifying about that talked about how the mainly the English-speaking workforce, mainly African and Caribbean workers, was replaced by a non-English-speaking Romanian workforce. And a similar thing happened in the underground, cleaning the underground. Somebody from the RMT spoke about that. And obviously, the hostile environment and employer sanctions, and particularly the creation of the criminal offence of working illegally in 2016, all of those things have exacerbated the vulnerability of migrant workers, particularly undocumented, who of course can be threatened and are threatened with deportation if they make a fuss. So in the face of that, obviously the only solution really is to organise through trade unions such as Unite, United Voices of the World, the Independent Workers of Great Britain, and they have done absolutely fantastic work in terms of organising a workforce that is very, very difficult to organise because it's fragmented, often doesn't speak English, and the fear is always there, right? So, but you will have seen, actually, because some of these things have made the national press, the sort of campaigns against outsourcing. So there was the big campaign at the University of London against the outsourcing of cleaning, maintenance, security, and so on, which has been successful. I think that was the IWGB. There was taxi drivers at Luton Airport working for Addison Lee, finding the amount of commission they had to pay and the rental on the cabs was going up and up and up, and then customers going down and down. And they have gone on strike. Uber drivers have gone on strike for recognition of their status as workers and therefore the rights to which they're entitled as workers. And last month, the International Transport Workers Federation succeeded in getting the Irish government to protect fisheries workers. They took a case against the Irish government saying that the government, permit system which tied, it's like in the Gulf, where a worker is tied to a particular employer, and if they leave that employer, they're out, yeah. So that obviously creates the conditions for modern slavery. And so the ITF actually took a case in the courts against the Irish government and saying you are facilitating slavery. And because the Irish government didn't want a ruling, they quickly changed the law to enable fisheries workers to change employers. So there was a similar campaign in relation to domestic workers in the 90s, which succeeded, and the Labour government changed the law so that domestic workers could leave abusive employers and could have a route to settlement, which was absolutely vital, so that through domestic work, you know, you could work for 5 years for different employers and then you could get a settlement. Tories took that away. So now the only route for domestic workers, they can change employers, but they can still only stay here for 6 months, which is pretty useless. I mean, who's going to employ somebody who says, well, I can only stay here for, you know. So anyway, that campaign is ongoing. There are groups like Walling Walling and Callaghan and, you know, Voice of Domestic Workers who are fighting that campaign for the right to stay and the right to a route of settlement, because they say, we don't want to be recognised as modern slaves. We don't want to have to go through all that stuff. We want rights as workers. We want to be recognised as workers. So that's examples of, well, obviously the importance of campaigning and awareness raising. So the next thing is connecting with the reluctant enforcers. So you've got the people in the NHS, and I mean, obviously the reluctant enforcers, if you come across a Home Office whistleblower, all well and good, but I don't actually particularly mean that you should befriend Home Office officials. Yeah, welcome them by all means if they come to you, but it's like recovering addicts, isn't it? You sort of bring them in, but otherwise keep them at arm's length. Okay, but I mean, what I mean is, yeah, obviously, more and more sectors are being conscripted into the hostile environment. At this stage, I proudly produced this report called The Embedding of State Hostility, a background paper on the Windrush scandal, which I wrote for the Institute of Race Relations. It's available online for free, and it tells you, gives you the whole history of the hostile environment in all its manifestations, but particularly the conscription of all the different sectors of civil society into immigration policing. And also the alignment of rights, like rights to healthcare, with immigration status. So doctors' organisations and medics generally have come out very strongly against the charging system whereby visitors and overstayers and people who can't prove their right to be here, as you know from the Windrush scandal, have to pay 150% of the costs of treatment, generally up front before they get treatment. So the BMA, the Lancet, the UK Faculty for Public Health have come out saying just how dangerous this charging regime is in terms of public health. The Maternity Action have come out, Docs Not Cops, MedAct. I mean, there's actually loads of action in the medical profession, Doctors of the World, Doctors for Human Rights. One of the people who gave evidence at the Permanent People's Tribunal Dr. Neil Russell was one of the so-called Ebola heroes who were given a number of NHS doctors went out to Sierra Leone during the last Ebola crisis there and risked their lives treating people. So they were given medals, and then 20 of them last August gave their medals back to the government saying, we're sorry, but we cannot accept these medals from a government which discriminates against people on the basis of their status and which denies life-saving treatment to people. So that was fantastic, and he came and gave evidence. And another really excellent initiative was a group called Migrants Organise, who have gone into hospitals and just talked to staff, because staff were not talking to each other about how they felt about having to impose these charges. They were all too embarrassed to talk about it, so they weren't talking about it. So all that Migrants Organised did was go in to the hospitals, organise little sort of chat groups, and ask people, how do you feel about this? And so then, of course, they were all able to express, the staff were all able to express their concerns and their dislike for it and how it went against the ethos of the NHS. So things like that, incredibly valuable. Obviously, there's still a lot of work to be done because the charges are still there. There was something in the paper the other day about doctors who can't afford to stay here because they're being charged huge, huge sums of money to renew their visas every year, plus £400 per member of their family for the health levy, which they have to pay. So that's £1,600 just for the health levy per year for a family of four, two adults, two kids, because it doubled this year. The other aspect of the NHS which people were up in arms about was the disclosure of information about patients to the Home Office for enforcement purposes. And that was suspended, and then the Home Office said, okay, we won't do it anymore, but I don't trust them, and I think they will reopen it sort of on a limited basis. They'll say, oh, it's just for, I don't know, criminals or something like that. That's what they always do. But anyway, so those are the issues in terms of health. Then you had a similar thing in education. With the schools census in 2016, the government, the Department for Education said, we're going to ask for the nationality and country of origin of all your pupils. So pupils were asked to give that information, although they were told it was voluntary. So this great campaign against Borders for Children was launched to boycott these questions, the school census. And it was successful, and the Department for Education withdrew the questions last year. But what was then discovered was that they have been, since I think 2015, the DfE has been using the other questions in the school census, you know, kids' names and addresses and so on, and passing that information to the Home Office on request to help in enforcement. So that campaign is still ongoing to prevent the data sharing, because obviously it puts parents off if they've got problems with their status. Then they're going to be frightened to send their kids to school, just as they're going to be frightened to get antenatal care or go to the doctor or whatever. So it's, you know, the big campaign there is to create firewalls between the provision of services and the information going to the Home Office. And it's the same with, you know, what I was talking about earlier, labour exploitation, that yes, it's fine having a gang masters and labour abuse authority going in and raiding places which are exploiting workers, particularly in the agriculture and food processing sector. But what's not fine is when they're accompanied, as they usually are, by border force officials. You know, so on the one hand, oh great, my conditions of employment are going to improve. Oh, shame I won't be around to enjoy it because I'm going to be deported. You know, you've got to build firewalls. So now I'm moving on to human rights defenders. So I attended the Lassen workshop and saw in various of the stalls about the provision of accommodation to destitute asylum seekers. So, you know, there's a number of, I think Abigail is another one that does that. So it did make me think about Anouk van Gestel and what was Miriam Berger? Yeah. So these two women, editor of Marie Claire Belgium and her colleague, who along with various other people were arrested in Brussels for putting up destitute asylum seekers, basically. So they are amongst a growing number of people across Europe who are being prosecuted for acts of kindness or acts of solidarity. The one we're all familiar with, obviously, is the Stansted 15. But obviously, breaking into an airport is a little bit more... I mean, you might expect to be arrested if you use bolt cutters on a perimeter fence of an airport, however justified your action is. But if you're just putting somebody up or giving them a lift or giving them some coffee and biscuits, let alone actually rescuing them at sea, you do not expect to be arrested. But that is what has been happening. So we produced a report in November 2017, because we got quite alarmed about this. So this is the report we produced, again, available on the website, downloadable for free. Humanitarianism, the Unacceptable Face of Solidarity. And in that report, we looked at, I think, about 25 prosecutions involving about 45 people over Europe, between 2015 and then. And we wrote to the European Commission because the EU's Facilitation Directive tells member states you must prosecute people who facilitate entry or stay of illegal aliens. There is an optional humanitarian clause. You do not have to prosecute people who are acting for humanitarian reasons. But because it's... Okay, so the UN Protocol on Smuggling, just to get legal for a minute, the UN Protocol Against Smuggling defines migrant smuggling as for profit. Yeah, so profit is essential to the offence for the UN. But the EU, when it transposed it into the Facilitation Directive, decided not to transpose the requirement for profit, which then means that, you know, member states can basically do what they like. So what's happened is particularly... So the EU does not... I mean, it's obvious. They do not want spontaneous migration. They do not want refugees arriving on their shores. They don't want it. So what do they do? A number of things. First of all, they refuse to lift the requirements for a visa, the carrier sanctions, which prevent refugees from Syria just getting on a plane or getting on a ferry across from Turkey to Greece or whatever, yeah? So they can't do that, what the rest of us take for granted. They've got to travel illegally. So you get more and more people travelling illegally on the boats get more and more overcrowded and dangerous and people start drowning. Italy in 2013 then set up this search and rescue and saved about over 100,000 people in the next year. The EU was then asked to fund it and the EU said no. Because basically it's a pull factor. Rescuing people from the sea is a pull factor and it just encourages more people to come. So what we're going to do is destroy the migrant boats because we think if we destroy the boats, then people won't come, which they know is completely untrue, because everything that they do to stop migration doesn't stop migration, it just forces people into more and more and more dangerous ways of travelling. Anyway, so of course the EU's not doing search and rescue, so you get NGOs, Médecins Sans Frontières, Save the Children, and then little crowd-funded NGOs buy a couple of boats and go off to the Mediterranean and rescue people. So they started to be prosecuted. So first of all, it was a group called Team Humanity and Pro-M Aid, Danish, Iraqi and Spanish firefighters rescuing some, responding to a distress call off the coast of Lesbos in January 2016. And they were arrested and taken back to shore and charged with assisting illegal immigration. They were acquitted in May 2018. 3 months later, another group of people were arrested on the same charge, but this time also charges of criminal organisation, espionage, forgery. I mean, you wouldn't believe it to talk about throwing the book at them. So there's these two people that we've been supporting, Sean and Sarah, who are volunteers who have been prosecuted in Lesbos again. And they don't know when the trial is going to come up, but we've been sort of providing support and help. And Sean came and spoke at a meeting at the Institute. So that's in, did I wave that one? No. This second one is an update which came out last month. It's called When Witnesses Won't Be Silenced, Citizens, Solidarity and Criminalisation. I mustn't rab it on for too long because, I just mustn't. I mean, there's an awful lot that could be said about that, but I won't go. I'll rely on you to, if you're interested, to look at the reports because all the information is there. But I want to move on to my next category of making the connections, which is the anti-globalisation and climate change. Okay, so there's articles that come out in the paper every now and then, which I always clip. So there was one a couple of weeks ago about, or was it? It was last week. Deforestation, about millions and millions of hectares of virgin forest in the Amazon, in Indonesia, and in the DRC, being deforested, and for things like palm oil plantations, cocoa beans, logging, obviously, gold mining, and beef. So what happens then, obviously, is that lots of species are destroyed, indigenous communities are displaced, and the deforestation fuels climate change. because obviously the trees absorb the carbon. What's that got to do with us? As well, apart from us as human beings, but us as campaigners around migration issues. So obviously people are saying, well, climate change is going to be an exponential rise in the number of refugees from climate change as places become more and more uninhabitable. But there's other ways in which you see the connection. So for example, Lake Chad, there was a really good article by Patrick Kingsley a few years ago in The Guardian about the shrinking of Lake Chad. It wasn't actually about that. It was about Boko Haram and the creation of millions of refugees in northeast Nigeria. But it made this connection between the shrinking of Lake Chad to one-tenth of its former size through climate change in the past 20 or 30 years. Then you see how this happens. People's livelihoods of, you know, fishing and all that are destroyed. They can't do it anymore. The water's just not there. Young people grow up with nothing to do, no work, and fall into things like Boko Haram. So then you get, it kind of drives conflict. Plus, of course, there's less food, so you've got sort of conflict over food. So when you look at land grabs that are going on all over the place, monoculture, then you look at things like, I don't know if you remember Bhopal, the Bhopal disaster in 1984 is one example of a multinational corporation completely destroying not only the people, it's just bloody tragic and awful, but that whole environment for miles around. Then you look at oil and Shell destroying so much through pollution of the Ogoni Delta, mining. So I read this brilliant book I always talk about. Well, there's two books that I always talk about. This one is called The Right to Stay Home. And it's a really important title because we never think about that. We might think in terms of, oh, you know, people are fleeing persecution and conflict and war. This is about, it's actually about multinational corporations and what they do. It's about US corporations in Mexico specifically, but it's absolutely generalizable to everywhere else because it's just showing how these corporations come in and destroy a local environment, either through mining or just through sort of taking people's land. Or, and this is the other book that I go on about, is called The Chicken Trail, and Annie will laugh because I always bring in chickens somewhere. It's about the industrialization of chicken production, this particular book, and it links it with destruction of union rights. It links it with very cheap chicken being exported to countries where poultry farming is still traditional. So then these cheap chickens undercut locally produced chickens. They all go out of, all the chicken farmers go out of business. And then you see how it all links up with migration. And actually the corporations in the States who run the processing factories are bringing in the Mexican migrant workers to undercut the unionized units. So you've got workforce replacement, yeah, the unionized African-American workers in southeast of America. So that book, The Chicken Trail, is just a microcosm of the way in which the corporatization, globalization of production links in. And then you've got the other one, The Right to Stay Home, which is also talking about environmental changes and how all of these things produce migration. And I just think it's incredibly important to make these connections, because we can't... It's important not just to look at it as a question of us being kind, you know, and us being nice and generous and warm and welcoming, which is obviously incredibly important. So I'm not knocking that. But it's also important for us to realise that it is a question of justice, that we, our corporations, corporations acting, from which we benefit because we get the cheap food, the cheap clothes made in Bangladesh, you know, the cheap everything. So we benefit from all of that. And so our lifestyles are actually built on, if you like, the backs of people who are being exploited all over the world, who can't live, who can't have a future where they are. And so then when they try and come to the rich world, because they think, well, I want a bit of that, they're told, well, you can't come here, you know, we're not having that. So it's a question of justice. And I think it is really important to link everything up and to see how the so-called refugee crisis, okay, Syria, well, you know, a lot of it is to do with rising food prices in Syria and why, and Egypt and places where the Arab Spring, yeah, where that took off. And so when you trace it back, a lot of it is sort of economic. And the distinction, I know that one of the workshops today was about these distinctions between migrants and asylum seekers and refugees. And now I come along and say, those distinctions don't hold. Well, of course they do. To some extent, they do hold. But they don't hold in the sense that there is a blurring, that you can't just say, well, those people are economic migrants. Because actually, if you look at the backstory, you know, there's a lot going on there. And the arms trade, I mean, I think that's self-explanatory. You know, we are, Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest customers of Britain's arms trade, which is why the government is refusing to stop selling it arms for the war on Yemen, despite the House of Lords International Relations Committee in February condemning those arms sales as unlawful, highly likely to be causing civilian casualties in significant numbers and risking violation of international humanitarian law. So, and it's, I don't have to explain to you how Britain's role in the arms trade fuels conflict everywhere. So, obviously you can't, none of us can join all of these campaigns. So the point about talking about them is just to say that there's no clear bright line between refugees who are good and economic migrants who are bad, and how racism and exploitation at home connect up with global policies which are pursued by and for an ever-shrinking elite. So that's me, and I welcome questions, comments, etc.
Are there any questions we'd like to ask Frances directly? And I'll pass you the microphone so we can all hear them.
My question is, as individuals facing needs, what would you say we could do individually to help with this? To help the global picture?
I think it's a question of being aware of when people go on about all these bloody asylum seekers coming over, that you can answer that. You can talk about the links. So I think self-education is very important. I don't know, I think that petitions, I'm honestly not sure about the value of petitions, but I still always sign them. And I seem to get about 4 or 5 a day through in my mailbox. So, you know, whenever there's something about, you know, tell Jeremy Hunt to stop doing this, that and the other, or tell Jeremy Hunt to sort of consider human rights when negotiating with whatever country, I tend to sign those petitions. So I do think it is important to let the politicians know that we are looking at them, that we're looking at what they're doing in terms of foreign relations, in terms of selling arms, so the climate change, obviously. See, I don't know how far you want to take it, but you could go so far as to sort of investigate the corporations. I mean, what I would love, I think we need a lot more transparency about labour supply chains. It's coming, but we need to sort of put pressure to get more transparency about supply chains, about where everything that we eat and wear and use, where it all comes from, and what the conditions of labour were in making or processing or whatever. Bless you. But also, there's an awful lot on the doorstep. I mean, Shirebrook isn't that far away, that warehouse in Nottinghamshire, where that woman gave birth in the toilet and then went straight back to work because she was so scared of losing her job. And then I think she was charged with child neglect or something. So because the workforce there were so frightened, they didn't even dare to sort of approach the union. What the union did, and this was Unite, they've got community branches which are worth exploring. So, you know, that means that obviously you don't have to be a member of a workforce to join the union, because it's a community union. And what the community union did, they all bought a share in Sports Direct, and which entitled them then to go to the AGM and to raise these questions at the AGM about Sports Direct's treatment of its workers. So that's, you know, that's a really good thing. So I would say, find out, you know, what the position is around here. Is there a community union that that you can join? You know, what are the? I don't know enough about Leeds to know, or West Yorkshire. You know, what warehouses, factories, etc. there are, what the conditions are like here, and whether something like that would be useful or not. So that's a few suggestions to be going on with.
I think that's really helpful. I think that's really good. Also, I thought it was a great question, because I think many people here today work with charities who have a specific object about delivering services. So it could automatically get them to campaigning. So to say, what can you do as an individual as well?
Mm.
That's very good, thank you. Is there any more? We've got time for maybe one more question. We've got one more question from there.
You mentioned about multinationals, and I was just wondering, on a local and also on a, you know, a high level, what is being done to kind of hold them to account for the havoc, really, that they're creating around the world?
So, I don't know if you all heard that, was a question about what is being done locally and nationally and internationally to hold multinationals to account for the havoc that they're causing around the world. Good question. Shell, actually, I'm sure I've got a cutting here about Shell, which is about awaiting, Shell is awaiting the verdict for on a case that has been taken against them by the widows of the Ogoni Nine, who were the environmental campaigners campaigning against oil pollution in the Ogoni Delta, who were executed on trumped-up charges in 1995 in Nigeria. And the widows have been fighting for over 20 years for Shell to be held accountable, because what they say is that the company relied on and asked for the protection of the Nigerian military, and it was at that time there was a military dictatorship in Nigeria, so to protect the oil installations from sabotage. So these women have taken a case saying that they were at the very least complicit in the fabrication of charges against these activists and their subsequent execution. So Shell is in court, and last week I read that a mining company, Vedanta, has been given permission by the Supreme Court, no, the company hasn't, sorry, 2,000 Zambians affected by toxic chemicals from the overspill or whatever from the mine, cadmium and lead and things, who lost relatives or whose health has been very badly affected, have been given permission to take a case here against the mining company, because they can't take a case in Zambia where it all took place. So there's legal action that is going on in various places, trying to bring multinationals to account for historic stuff. But the thing is that Shell has still not cleaned up in that delta. It's still completely polluted, as is the whole area around Bhopal, because Union Carbide have not cleared up. So it's still toxic for people living there. So we need, I think it's coming, but it's very, very slow, because obviously the vested interests are huge and the amount of money. I mean, one good thing about America, I have to say, is that there is a tradition, and it's coming here as well, a tradition of public interest litigation against multinationals. You remember the tobacco companies being sort of having to pay millions of dollars to people who have suffered as a result of them suppressing what they knew about the damage of smoking. So it just all takes an awfully long time. There are a lot of initiatives going on. The Permanent People's Tribunal have also done tribunals on these things, on the damage that multinational corporations cause as violations of human rights. Yeah. So they are public opinion tribunals. Obviously, they don't actually get hold of somebody in the same way that a court case does, but they create public awareness. And so, I mean, obviously, that's a hugely important thing, is the public awareness thing, is to sort of try and get these things into schools for kids to learn about them, if that's at all possible. And becoming a shareholder so that you can go to AGMs and make a fuss, and, you know, I guess. You can do that.
Thank you. We asked for a lecture. We got a tour de force, didn't we? I think you've raised our eyes for the horizon. So thank you.
Oh, thanks.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Leeds Church Institute. If you'd like to know more about the Leeds Church Institute, visit lcileeds.org.